Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Friday, December 9th, 2016, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call, as today we discuss potential presidential conflicts. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We are very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. We'll be getting opening remarks from each of them in turn in just a minute, and then, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions for when we get to that portion of the program. One special note about today's call, sort of proving that this is a breaking news topic, one of our guests at 20 after the hour will be doing a live MSNBC interview, so he'll be leaving us for about 5 minutes, maybe slightly longer than that, but then we'll rejoin the call. So we'll get opening remarks to begin from Mr. David B. Rifkin. He's a partner at Baker Hostetler right here in Washington, D.C. He'll be followed by Professor Richard Painter. He's the S. Walter Ritchie Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. With that, Mr. Rifkin, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. I'll just briefly make 3 points. I think Richard and I, and pretty much anybody else who's written on this set of issues, agrees that there's no statutory bar, there's no statutory provisions that apply to the handling of the investments, business investments, or any other investments by the president or vice president. The arguments in favor of a proposition which Richard has made as to why President-elect Trump should divest, which is a fancy way of saying sell all of his holdings, and then put the resulting proceeds in blind trust, fall into two categories. One category is an argument that there is a practice that has existed for many, many years in our history of a president is doing so, and somehow for President-elect Trump not to follow his practice would not only create a conflict-prone situation, but would be an unwelcome break with his practice. I would say historically that is not a correct argument. The people, presidents who put their assets in blind trusts, did it with their financial assets. That's what blind trusts are set up to do. I don't know of any president in our history who has tried to put a business asset, which is what President-elect Trump basically has, in a blind trust. I think Richard would agree would not work. Nor do I know of any president that actually was compelled through pressure of public opinion and other considerations to sell his business property. In fact, I know 5 presidents who've done the reverse, and that is the case with Jimmy Carter, who had his peanut farm managed not very well, I should say, during his tenure in the White House, and then came back and re-engaged, but obviously did not sell it. We also are talking about President Hoover, who had substantial mining properties. Again, less clear how they were managed during his time in the White House, but he certainly did not sell his properties. Of course, three of our very early presidents, Washington, Jefferson, and Madison, had very large plantations that were also managed, sometimes actually more directly by them, sometimes not, but they did not sell them. All right. My last point is that Richard and others are making this claim that the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution, which is Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8, somehow bars broadly the receipt of payments from foreign entities by the president. I think that claim is overly broad. There's a great deal of OC learning on the subject that indicates that while the term emolument is broad, it is actually cabined in a variety of ways. For example, OC opinions that make clear this was in the context of explaining why President Reagan could continue to receive his pension as the former governor of California. The term emolument is limited to payments which have a potential of influencing or corrupting the integrity of recipients and does not apply to all payments. There are OC opinions that make clear that many foreign entities, even government-affiliated entities, are not, quote, instrumentalities of foreign government. That was done in the context, for example, of OOC allowing December of 2009 a blessing President Obama's receipt, a very substantial Nobel Peace Prize. But perhaps the most important point, which I think Richard and other critics overlook, is that if you look at the language of emolument clause, it applies, it talks about no person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States shall without consent of Congress accept of any president, et cetera, et cetera, emolument. It's pretty well known that Mr. Trump does not run any of his business properties as sole proprietorship. He runs them as different types of corporations and then OCs. There's a technical matter. Whatever payments are received by those entities would not be payments made to the person who is holding any office of property trust under the United States. Mr. Trump would be a shareholder of such entities. And by its very nature, by its language, the Emolument Clause does not apply to him. Now, my final sentence. There undoubtedly could and should be rules put in place that would, A, get Mr. Trump, President-elect Trump, out of the business of managing his business properties, and would provide White House Counsel's office with wide latitude to scrutinize particular transactions engaged into by his various business entities. I believe such a commitment should be made. I think that those types of arrangements would amply mitigate any conflict of interest that might arise, and certainly would be a matter of good policy. Again, not compelled by law or constitution, but would be sound as a matter of policy. Thank you.
Professor Painter, you want to give us your opening remarks before you have to break away?
Yes. Well, I think that we hopefully share a common objective, which is to help President-elect Trump have this be a successful presidency. And part of that is going to have a presidency that is as free from conflict of interest as possible. Let's start with some of the historical examples of conflicts of interest. The large plantations held by Presidents Washington and Jefferson and by some members of Congress created one of the most tragic conflicts of interest in American history. We failed to deal with the slavery question at the founding of this country and paid a miserable price for that in our Civil War, 500,000 Americans killed in that war, and the legacy of race discrimination to this day. So conflicts of interest for presidents and members of Congress have serious consequences. We don't just simply look to the past and say that was done then and it's acceptable now. More recently, we think about presidents of the 20th century and mining interests certainly have created conflicts of interest, and that was not a good thing for President Hoover. But imagine where we would have been if President Roosevelt had held real estate holdings in Germany, and Roosevelt buildings in Berlin and Frankfurt, and large loans outstanding from Deutsche Bank in 1940, 1941. That is not the type of situation we need to be in if a president is going to stand up to foreign dictators. An effective president is going to mitigate as much as possible those types of conflicts of interest, whether or not a specific statute that would criminalize conflicts of every interest for everyone working for the president, whether or not that statute applies to him. The Emoluments Clause clearly does apply to the president and would prohibit payments from foreign governments and entities controlled by foreign governments. The Nobel Peace Prize it was from funds that were coming out of a private foundation set up by Mr. Nobel, and the Office of Legal Counsel saw that that was private money and decided that the appropriate resolution of that was that the president could take the Nobel Peace Prize. But it's quite clear if there's a corporation controlled by a foreign government, that is an impermissible emolument for anyone holding a position of trust with the United States government. Now let's look at the receiving side. It would just be absolutely ridiculous to argue that someone who cannot receive a present or other emolument from a foreign government could do so simply by being a shareholder of a corporation if they are the sole shareholder or controlled shareholder. Obviously, if you're a shareholder of a large corporation such as Boeing, you do not receive an emolument because Boeing receives a contract from the government of Saudi Arabia for an airplane. That is very different than owning a corporation that you control and receiving the emoluments, the payments through that corporation. I think it's critically important if President-elect Trump does not choose, as I have recommended, to sell off his assets, his businesses, it's going to be critically important to make sure that the foreign government payments are removed from any and all of the businesses that he retains. Otherwise, we risk a constitutional crisis if the House of Representatives were at any point to turn on him and to say there's a violation of the Monuments Clause. He should certainly go to the Office of Legal Counsel and find out what the proper resolution is of emoluments questions before accepting the money. And it's very important to do that ahead of time. And one comment about the blind trust. You clearly don't put the business in a blind trust and leave it there. You do have to sell the business when you use the blind trust mechanism. And then the trustee can invest the money in assets of the trustee's choosing, but the trustee does not tell the office holder about. An alternative to the blind trust is to take the money from the sale of the assets and invest it in treasury securities or mutual funds or other conflict-free assets. And that's an option as well. But I do think that President-elect Trump needs to confront the reality that he has been elected President of the United States. He has a very important job to do. And to the extent he can, sell off these family businesses at good prices, and I think he can get a good deal for a lot of these businesses. I think that's the way he ought to go. And then he could focus on being president. And my last concern, we've got to make sure that he's not having his name go up on buildings all over the world. That is an avenue through which people would be paying money to him. That's going to look terrible with respect to ethics. And, of course, there's a national security risk. Some of these buildings are in countries with security issues. And we would not want to have the Obama Tower in downtown Johannesburg or downtown Paris or someplace like that. And the same for Mr. Trump. The fact that he's been in that business before doesn't mean he ought to stay in it. The presidency is not a branding opportunity. And I don't think he wants to use it that way. I think he wants to be a good president. And I think these are the steps he needs to take in order to be a good president.
Very good. That was Professor Richard Painter. We've got about 7 minutes by my clock here before Professor Painter needs to take a break for a live television interview. Instead of going to audience questions, let me give David Rivkin a chance to speak again so that Professor Painter can be sure to hear what David Rivkin has, even if he can't respond until after he returns. But with that, David Rivkin.
Thank you. I think that we can all agree that the language of a given constitutional clause or statutory clause matters. I don't think that there's any serious dispute. The emolument clause applies only in circumstances where payments are made by foreign governments and instrumentalities of foreign governments to the person holding any office of profit or trust under the United States. We as lawyers also know that there is a fundamental difference between shareholders and corporations, be they C-Corps, S-Corps, LOCs. So I'm a little puzzled by the notion that you're going to stretch the emolument clause to apply to a circumstance where the president is a shareholder in a business organization, the business organization receiving this money. I don't think it's a serious argument. So all we're left with then, Richard, is a kind of a forceful advocacy of a particular policy position. Well, let me say two things. First of all, you have to consider the consequences of establishing this new baseline. Let's be clear. No president in American history has been forced to sell business assets. So if we do it for Trump, if we expect that of President-elect Trump, that would be the new baseline. Ladies and gentlemen, what is the consequence of that baseline? We have just created the most powerful disincentive for any businessman, for any entrepreneur to run for the office of president or vice president, therefore leaving the field essentially to members of political class and in some circumstances, investors, a Warren Buffett type. I would submit to you they would not be in the national interest since American people are plenty sick and tired of the political class rotating in and out of the White House and is definitely interested in having entrepreneurs. Why be a tremendous disincentive? Richard, I'm sure you agree, but the whole point of being an entrepreneur is distinct from being an investor, is you build something, you pour your heart in it. It's not just about money. I mean, would you expect Henry Ford fairly early in his career to sell, you know, Ford Motor Company? I mean, whatever you think of these businesses, the branding side and the business organization side is the labor of love and the labor of his entire life, for present life. And that's true of every entrepreneur. So this baseline would discourage people from doing it. Now, as to your speculation about how those things would work out, again, there is a way, a perfectly reasonable way of having President-elect remove himself from any operational control. He would remain only the beneficial owner. Pledges can be made that he would not even be told about any business activities engaged in all those enterprises. He will not inquire. He would not be told. And arrangements can be made that every business arrangement that involves a foreign government or instrumentality of a foreign government by any of those business entities would be scrutinized by Office of the White House Counsel. Bob Richard and I worked at different times with the necessary input from OLC, who would vet everything to determine what is the appropriate way to proceed. Would not involve the president, would only involve people who are running those entities. And again, this would be a new arrangement. This would be an arrangement that no other president in American history has submitted to. I fail to see why that would not sufficiently resolve any potential conflict of interest, why we have to go for an unfair and draconian solution that would have negative policy consequences down the road.
Richard Painter here, kind of respond to this very briefly before I go on.
Go ahead.
I believe that, you know, there are ways that President-elect Trump could hold on to some of these businesses and avoid these problems. So he's going to attack them piece by piece and take each problem seriously. I think it'll be a lot easier for him to divest and to invest the proceeds as he chooses. If he chooses to, on the other hand, hold on to the businesses, he needs to take these problems seriously. And the argument that you could receive through ownership of a corporation that you control, that you could receive payments that would otherwise be illegal, is just flat out wrong. And I think if the president pursues that, it is going to not work legally, and it is going to be a political disaster. That's the type of argument, the type of gamesmanship that is wrong, and I don't think that he would do that. And I think something is either permitted or it's not under the Emoluments Clause. You don't just set up a corporation and take the gift, the payment, which is otherwise illegal. It's either illegal or it's not. And the president-elect will need to focus on that when he becomes president, if he continues to own these businesses, and he will need to consult with the Office of Legal Counsel. And I don't think that OLC will sign off on shell corporations receiving gifts that he couldn't receive. So that's going to be very important. I think many, many entrepreneurs have had successful businesses and then have had an initial public offering and have sold off shares in the businesses. Many families do that. I think that's the best option for him. It's not the only option. It's the best option. And I hope he does it. If he doesn't, though, we're going to have to be very, very careful about each specific problem that comes up with ownership of these businesses and take them seriously, so he can be a good president.
Very good. That was Professor Richard Painter. We're on, in case you joined us late, with Professor Richard Painter and Mr. David Rifkin of Baker Hostetler. We're going to lose Professor Painter from about now for another 5 to 8 minutes or so. He will return to the call. Until he does, and even after he does, why don't we open the floor to questions at this point in time? Obviously, we'll only hear responses from David Rifkin. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, I see Richard Painter still on right now, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first question of the day.
Hi, this is Jim Markowski in New York. This is really directed at Professor Painter. The proposal of an IPO may sound workable in theory, but I suspect you've probably never worked on a $9 billion initial public offering of a global company with hundreds of separate entities that are in that global organization. Realistically, that deal could take years. It'll be the next election by the time the IPO gets done and consume vast amounts of time of the president-elect and would involve probably far more conflicts than him continuing to actually run his business. I mean, how would you respond to that?
I'm afraid Professor Painter left us for a few minutes to
okay.
do the interview. But not to be snarky, this is David Rifkin. I think it's exactly right.
I was a little snarky myself. So.
Yeah. Any effort to divest, especially precipitously, let's say between now and January 20th, is impossible unless you do a fire sale. And even after, and if you continue it after January 20th, it itself is going to engender many interests. So what, you're supposed to make sure that nobody who buys it has any foreign affiliations? I mean, that just that whole thing is silly to me. It just shows you that solutions being advocated is no better than the status quo, and worse than status quo as adjusted with some of the measures that I suggested.
Yeah, well, between now and inauguration, it would be impossible. It wouldn't comply with any of the SEC filing requirements for the S-1, et cetera. And having worked on a $3 billion IPO, it took 2.5 years and still almost didn't happen the night before the IPO because some little glitch almost blew it up. So, I mean, that's, as I said, in theory, it may be conceptually workable, but in the real world, it borders on the absurd.
Once again, if you have a question, we're with David Rifkin for the time being alone. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions pending. Let's take another call now.
This is Jack Park. I'm just wondering how direct an emolument payment would have to be. Assume a Saudi prince and his entourage of, 300 people decides to stay at a Trump hotel instead of a Hyatt facility. Would that trigger concern on your part?
No. Well, let's say again, if I were looking at this transaction, and I was in the White House counsel's office today, I would have said absolutely not, unless you can demonstrate that they overpaid two things. Again, paying money to an entity that does not hold an office in the U.S. government is not technically a violation of a emolument clause, no way, no how. But from a perspective of sound policy, I agree with Richard that ethics should be guided by policy and appearances and not just by the black letter law, statutory, constitutional. I would say this: if the Saudi prince paid the normal rate for those rooms that everybody else pays, I would see absolutely, if I was asked to scrub this transaction and issue an opinion, I would see no problem with it. If the Saudi prince paid 10 times or try to pay 10 times or 3 times or whatever the charge room rate, I would say that it would look extremely inappropriate.
Thanks, David.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Edwin Williamson. I was having to switch phones. Has Richard left?
He's left momentarily, Edwin. I expect him back in 2 or 3 minutes. Did you have a question for him specifically, or?
Yeah, really more for him.
Why don't you just hold on for a second? I'll ask David Rifkin a question, and maybe in the interim here we'll get Richard Painter back. David, directly as you can, what is the legal standard here that should apply? When I was in law school, it was all about conflicts or the appearance of a conflict or the appearance of impropriety. And does it make a difference here that the president's – I mean, are we trying to apply a lawyer standard to a non-lawyer office holder?
This is a good question. I think we're applying a common – or at least I suggest – but a common sense standard of avoiding an appearance of impropriety be applied. There's no technical standard to apply here because, with all due respect to Richard, the Emolument Clause does not apply at all. Even in a situation where the payment is coming from a foreign government. I mean, let's say there is a Trump hotel, not hotel, office building somewhere, and a foreign government wishes to rent space there. Okay? So So technically not a conflict because the money would not go to a president-elect. But you can come up with a common sense set of provisions that reassure at least the reasonable portion of the pundits and the American people that there's no conflict here. So apropos of a question, if a Saudi prince with, you know, 20 hangers-on stays at the hotel, pays the standard room rate, that's one thing. No problem. In a situation, you know, where something is being rented out, if it's all arm's length and the rent is normal, no problem. I think, again, there may be transactions that would not look particularly particularly appropriate. In that case, again, I would be looking for a commitment in advance to abide by whatever decisions the White House Counsel's Office makes with input from OOC. Again, would be unprecedented, but I think they'll be very reassuring and would more than mitigate the conflicts of interest or appearances thereof.
So we still don't have Richard Painter back, but this is Dean Reuter again, David. It seems to me that you know the pieces in place right now might be different or perceived to be different than something that a businessman slash president Donald Trump might come up with in the future. In other words, nothing as it exists right now was contrived with the idea that he's going to be president and be able to take advantage of his position. That seems less true of business enterprises or big changes in his business he makes going forward. Is that correct, and does that matter?
Again, look, let me put it this way. No, you have to at some point in time accept inevitability of the following or rather true for the following proposition, and that is, the President of the United States is one of the most powerful men in the world. No matter what steps he takes, whether it's a blind trust or divestiture and putting money in a blind trust, there's no question that numerous policies he's going to pursue are going to have impact on the economy and therefore on his holdings, whether it's business assets, Dean, or stockholders. I mean, ask yourself this question. If President Trump, contrary to what I'm suggesting, were to sell his assets and let's say got $9 billion or $10 billion and put it in a blind trust, do you think he cannot possibly figure out what is the impact on, even if he doesn't know which stock, which is the whole blind trust part, is in the portfolio, he cannot figure out what is the impact of reducing corporate tax rate, of pursuing, a particular type of economic policy, of reducing regulatory burdens? You think it would not be clear to him that that would greatly increase the value of his holdings, even if he doesn't know particulars? You just have to accept this reality. By the way, if you really want, in an absolute way, to make sure that no decision the president makes can ever impact his own interest, you have to go beyond blind trust. If a person is wealthy, you basically have to say, look, not only Trump has to sell his business holdings, he has to donate the money to charity. Because if you have modest amounts of money in your possession, then the impact of various policies is not going to be that great. But not in the case with $10 billion. It's a reality. American people elected a very wealthy individual with substantial holdings that does not bother them at the most fundamental level, and appropriate measures can be taken to scrutinize specific transactions to ensure that nothing untoward happens.
Right. So we still don't have Professor Painter back, so let me ask you another question, Mr. Rifkin, and that's how do you distinguish this from what I think was generating a fair amount of concern before the election, and that was a hypothetical President Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation Trust, and how do you distinguish those two cases, and what should she have done under that circumstance versus what Mr. Trump should do here?
Well, the fundamental difference here is, we're not talking about the Emoluments Clause here either.
Right.
Because let me be clear, nobody accused Secretary Clinton of taking any money from foreign governments. The fact that her husband was taking money from foreign governments created a serious appearance problem, but it is not subject to the Emoluments Clause for the same reason that I mentioned earlier, which is to say he was not holding the office under the United States at the time he took those payments. As far as the situation with the Clinton Foundation, the whole argument there was that the payments made to the Clinton Foundation in a situation where she was providing specific benefits to specific donors to the foundation in effect amounted to an unlawful quid pro quo, but it violated the statutory prohibition against bribery, okay?
Right.
And even if it did not, it certainly created a horrible appearance from Friday. Because, look, she knew who was making contributions to the Clinton Foundation. She was meeting with some of those people, okay? And she was making decisions that impacted those people. Think about how different it is from a situation where President-elect relinquishes any operational role, does not know anything anymore because he's not discussing it with people who are running it, and they're not discussing anything with him, does not know what's going on. Therefore, the only connection there is he going to pursue policies that are in general beneficial, for example, of a hospitality industry, okay? And back to my point that no matter what you've done with your money, if you're a wealthy enough person, you could always deduce the impact of your economic policies, of your fiscal policies, of your tax policies on the value of your assets. And that is perfectly acceptable both as a legal matter as an appearance of impropriety matter.
Very good. I'm going to suggest we leapfrog Edwin Williamson. Edwin, we still don't have Professor Painter on the line, so we've got four other questions pending. If you want to ring back in, Edwin, when we get Professor Painter back, we'll revert to you. But let's take another call now.
Yes, hi, guys. Kevin Hall with McClatchy Newspapers. Sounds like I went blank here. Can you guys hear me?
We can hear you. Go right ahead, sir.
Good. Yeah. We talked a lot about him, but the indications are that he's going to have a role for his daughter and son-in-law somehow, either formal or informal, and operational control to the older boys with he and Ivanka, retaining some sort of ownership stake but not operational interest. How should he go about dealing with the family ties? Because there's plenty of evidence that the organization has kind of commingled funds with the individual children's investments, and those investments don't appear on his disclosure form, for instance, the North Carolina Titan issue with one of the sons. So how do you think they should be handling the children's businesses as well?
Well, I've actually talked about it a little bit in my Washington Post piece, but I would say a couple of things. First of all, you know, the children's businesses, to the extent that there's the children's own some businesses in America, for example, from what I understand, a couple of business ventures they're entirely her own. Nothing really should be on the table here, okay, for the same reason that it may have been a little unseemly for Bill Clinton to be receiving, you know, $1 million speaking fees from foreign government-affiliated entities. Nothing applies to family members. If, on the other hand, you have a combined children and the president-elect business asset, it should be governed by the same rules as his business assets that he owns as a sole shareholder. Now, that's point number one. Point number two, when it comes to, which also been criticized, his intent to seek advice from his children. Look, every president seeks advice from a variety of sources, okay, including his family, to the extent that they're not government employees, okay, but, you know, seeks advice from them in sort of in their capacity as people he knows and trusts. It would be appropriate for him to pledge and for them as well, in some kind of a joint statement, that they will only discuss matters that do not bear upon their own specific business ventures. So, for example, to give you perhaps a silly hypothetical, if he wants to ask his children how he should proceed with opening to Cuba, should he reverse what was done under President Obama, or should he continue? That is a perfectly appropriate question. He should not ask his children, they should not volunteer, any views on, you know, whether something should be done to help a hospitality industry get a foothold in Cuba. Again, it's a common sense distinction.
Would you say that the children, certainly Ivanka, sitting in on a couple of meetings where one would presume it would be unthinkable for a business competitor, whether that at least had the appearance of benefiting from proximity?
Well, but look, we don't know what exactly transpired in those meetings. These were meetings with foreign government officials. He obviously trusts his daughter's judgment. She was there. There's absolutely no indications that any specific business ventures were discussed. To tell me if I'm wrong, and there are no indications that the government officials, senior government officials, foreign government officials who met with President-elect are in the business of conducting any business ventures. That's not their job. But also, let me say this again. This is common sense stuff. Let's be real. Is there any person in the world who does not know whose daughter Ivanka is, or the fact that she's highly esteemed by President-elect?
Yeah.
So to the extent one has a problem with that situation, what is Ivanka supposed to do? Go join the monastery while her father is in the White House and not engage in any business transactions? What I'm saying is the fact that you said in some meeting does not really alter those fundamental realities.
Right. I'm just trying to get a sense of whether there's any sort of way. One of the distinctions, of course, is that these are privately held companies. They're Delaware LLCs. So there's virtually no information that the public sees. There's virtually no information on his case, and the disclosures are so broad that there's very little disclosure. For example, do we know when, and it was 564 LLCs, 380 in Delaware, whether they have foreign partners in them. We don't know. There's no way to know that.
Understood, but if I may, let me remind you that one of the things I'm suggesting, respectfully, again, I'm just, you know, I'm being a pundit here. I'm obviously not involved in working this out, that there should be a pledge made that White House Counsel's office may require, you know, to hire additional staff with the help of OLC, would scrutinize all of those transactions. And if American people are told that, I think that would have high confidence that those matters be handled properly. I served in the White House under two administrations. I can assure you at the White House Counsel's office, and I think Richard would agree with me if he would hear it, I'm not yes man. They are perfectly capable of saying no. So what I'm looking for is sort of double security, a promise to disclose every transaction involving foreign entities to the White House Counsel's office and a pledge to abide by their decision. So if they were to conclude with a particular transaction, particular venture, while perfectly legal, because it's not about the law, just creates an appearance of impropriety, an appearance of conflict, they would not go forward. And the president would not even know about this, because all of it would take place without, you know, in a context where he's not being given any information. Okay?
Once again, we have David Rifkin on the line. I don't think we have Professor Painter back yet. Professor Painter, if you're on the line and we don't see you, if you could push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone, we'll be able to pick you out. In the meantime, let's continue to wade through our questions with our audience members.
Hello?
Go ahead, caller. We can hear you.
Yeah, hi, Paul Kaminar. David. I quite agree with you that it'd just be unworkable to divest of all the assets, as Professor Painter suggested. Just a couple questions following up on what's been asked already. One with respect to Ivanka coming on board. You talked about the conflict. What is the nepotism rule with regard to her or her husband being an advisor? And number two, what do you say to those who say, well, there may be a conflict in the sense that even though he's turning over management to his sons, that if he needs a permit for one of his assets, a golf course, whatever, in a foreign country or a hotel, and the government's likely to give that permit when it otherwise would not, to curry favor with the president, you know, how do you kind of disclose that or work about that? And finally, I saw in the news where he's going to continue to be or will be the executive producer of The Apprentice, and that's something new he's adding, I guess, to his portfolio. But I guess the counter-argument was that Reagan still received residuals from his movies while he was president. So anyway, there's just sort of a couple questions to throw out there and how you think
right.
those would be handled.
I'll take them in reverse order. Indeed, Reagan received residuals and received a pension that he earned while serving as the governor of California. There is a June 23, 1981 OC opinion that specifically distinguishes between payments rendered for something that happened in the past, okay, and emoluments or compensation for something that's being done now while the person is holding the office of a profit or trust under the United States. So that's pretty easy. I mean, on the second issue, again, if we proceeded what I outlined, which is president would not know anything about any particular project involving foreign government. So, and his children would pledge not to tell him anything about it. So how exactly would a foreign government hope to curry, and again, it would be widely, you know, widely known, how would the president, so how would the foreign government attempt to curry favor? So they would, you know, approve super quickly a golf course, and whoever is running those properties would be happy. Maybe Ivanka would be happy. Maybe Jared Kushner would be happy. But the president would not know anything about it. So how do you curry favor with somebody who does not know that you've rendered a favor? And again, I think that that's pretty much common sense. As to the nepotism stuff, it is a totally different issue. There is indeed an anti-nepotism statute that was enacted after the experience of having President Kennedy, be it for a very short time, of course, before he was assassinated in the White House, and his brother as the Attorney General. I happen to have serious doubts about the constitutionality of that statute, given the joint power dispersed between the president and the Senate of making nominations, and the Senate giving advice and consent. So I think that any restrictions on president's ability to nominate somebody are presumptively unconstitutional because they trench upon what is the president's plenary authority and introduce new constraints. Moreover, once the Senate, if we're talking about a confirmable job, if the Senate confirms somebody for their job, that would, again, to let the statute govern in that situation, the anti-nepotism statute would be unconstitutional. Now, if this is a question of somebody who's not receiving advice and consent because he's not, Senate's advice and consent, he's not a principal officer, I think it would be a closer question, but still, I think that any statutory restriction on the president's ability to choose his advisors and aides is fundamentally unconstitutional. So, yes, it would technically violate the anti-nepotism statute, but I think it's unconstitutional.
We still do have a couple questions pending, and I still don't see Professor Painter back with us. Let's take the next question.
Hey, good afternoon. This is Gerard Lehman in the Boston chapter. David, I was just wondering if what the Supreme Court did in McDonald relative to the definition of official acts informed how you see this issue at all.
Well, I'm certainly a fan of the unanimous McDonald's decision. Not sure it really informs my views here because there's no question that the president-elect, once he's in the White House, President Trump, will be taking a variety of official actions. There's also absolutely no question that he will not be receiving any payments for it. And again, in the scenario that I've described now several times, he would not be aware of any specific arrangements involving his business properties and foreign governments or foreign government-affiliated entities.
Still two questions mm-hmm. pending. We've got some time left, about 15 minutes, so let's carry on here.
Hi. It seems to me that if Trump can implement his promises to reduce regulation and interference in all aspects of business that were implemented under Roosevelt, this would all be academic. So would you agree that if he fulfills his campaign promises, there are no interests that he has that can be affected by any action that he takes as a government official?
No, I'm not sure I understand the premise of a question.
The premise is that under FDR, all aspects of business became the purview of the federal government. And prior to that, they were not. You opened a hotel in a city and the federal government had nothing to say about it. So the deregulation that he's promising as a campaign promise might reverse that, and anything he does as president wouldn't have any interest or influence on his interests because government would no longer be interfering with every aspect of business.
Well, all right, I understand. Let me say this. I can envision circumstances where lessening the governmental footprint in terms of its impact on various business matters would remove circumstances where some of the decisions that the president makes would have an impact. But let's be real. Again, given how much of an impact the federal government has, and it would not recede to zero, that's for sure, over all aspects of our economy, of all aspects of our lives, any person with substantial assets, held in blind trust, not held in blind trust, is going to know how various policies that he or she is driving are impacting his private affairs. Let's acknowledge it. Let's embrace it. It's inevitable. But to the extent that that impact is sufficiently attenuated, sufficiently diffused, and to the extent that the president is doing something based upon, and I suppose, call me naive, I'll take his word for it, based upon what he thinks is good for the nation, that's okay. So if President Trump thinks it's good for the nation, for example, not to have a $15 minimum wage, the fact that it will also be good for the hotel business is just fine. It doesn't bother me, and I don't think it's going to bother most Americans. And the flip side of that is if to the extent it bothers people, but no entrepreneur can ever be, no really wealthy person can ever be president. And I don't think only people can be president then, forget my point about investors. So no investors, no entrepreneurs, only members of a political class. Has it worked well for us? Are the American people happy with what they got?
No. But of course, under campaign finance, every congressman has had to become a multimillionaire before he can afford to run for Congress.
Well, I understand, but with respect, I don't see how the campaign finance issue fundamentally alters the equation here. I mean, tell me if it makes
the way it would alter it is. Is that every congressman has of necessity had to be a businessman or an heir, and therefore it's common that government officials have business interests.
Well, actually, I don't
elected.
Think most members of Congress are businessmen. You have some small business owners, you have some lawyers, you have some doctors.
But nobody can afford to run unless they're at least a millionaire. I think they're all millionaires in Congress at this point.
But in fact, that's a different issue. The issue here is what are the arrangements that would help President-elect Trump mitigate his conflict of interest? What you're suggesting, I frankly disagree with, for many other reasons, including the proper interpretation of the First Amendment. But what does it have to do with, frankly, the subject of his discussion, which is, again, what President-elect Trump should do?
Abolish all regulations so he doesn't have a conflict of interest.
But that's realistic. I mean, again, we don't know each other, but I'm very, very keen to deregulate many areas. But the notion you can abolish all regulations is risible in part because, while been regulatory overreach under President Obama, many regulations, not all, but many regulations are indeed a result of a faithful execution duty that Article 2 owes to Article 1. So Congress passed Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act and, you know, various other, statutes that implemented by alphabet soup agencies. And many regulations promulgated under those statutes are indeed statutorily compelled. So how the heck do you abolish it? Are you going to go to Congress and try to eliminate all the melange of statutes that, you know, some of which date back to a New Deal? Is that plausible? I don't think it would be a good idea, because there has to be a healthy balance between some regulation and lots of deregulation. So I don't see it as either possible or a good thing.
We do have one other question pending, so now let's turn to another caller, if we could.
This is Edwin Williamson. I gave up on Richard's return, but I do have some questions for David, too. So basically, the things I wanted to point out, raised with Richard, are the fact that the OLC is all over the place on its interpretation of the Emoluments Clause. In one place, as Richard says, they have said that any entity owned or controlled by a foreign government, would be a foreign state.
I'm sorry. Can you say it again, Richard? Edmund, can you say it again?
I'm getting some static on this. Okay. So OLC has said that any operation, any entity owned or controlled by a foreign government is a foreign state within the meaning of the Emoluments Clause. Yet, despite the fact that the Nobel Prize Committee is selected by the Norwegian Parliament, they didn't find that committee was therefore a foreign state. So you've got some inconsistency there.
Well, if I can clarify, this specific opinion, this is December 7, 2009 opinion, pivots upon the following fact that Storting,
But David, I'm just pointing this out. It is not concerned by the fact that this entity is controlled by a foreign government. That was
no, it is not. You're absolutely right. But that actually cuts, and maybe you disagree, but cuts my way rather than Richard's way, because the thrust of his position.
It is wrong that this is that any entity that is controlled by a foreign government is therefore a foreign state within.
Absolutely, and there are other examples of awards that given to other U.S. government officials that OLC has blessed. But I think for listeners, it'd be useful to appreciate again how nuanced this whole thing is. That it's not all emoluments of whatever kind. OLC primarily ruled.
Hold on a second. I don't want to take up too much time here. So, and the other thing is that Richard seems to somehow decide that any payment is an emolument.
Right.
I don't think it's clear, but I think within the definition of emolument is the concept of a profit from an office, and therefore doing a deal with somebody isn't an emolument.
You absolutely
on the,
right.
The things that Richard has proposed, specifically an IPO and a leveraged buyout, I'd just like to point out that by the time the Trump takes office, three members of the SEC will three seats on the SEC will be vacant within the time that it would take for a leverage or an IPO to be completed. The other two would have become vacant. The head of the Division of Corporation Finance has indicated that he's out of there, so Trump would be in effect appointing everybody responsible for regulating an IPO. A leverage buyout would involve massive lending by banks, who are, of course, regulated by a Trump administration. David, on your point, your proposal of this elaborate firewalls and the OL and White House counsel reviewing every transaction with a foreign entity or what have you, this is just simply setting up a trap. And so instead of the Richard Painters and the media focusing on whether or not there's a serious conflict of interest, it's going to be focusing on a question whether or not Trump knew about it, what was talked about at Thanksgiving dinner table, and it's going to, you know, result in a demand for a corporate-style monitor, $1,000 to $1,500 an hour, ex-federal prosecutor, and so forth. That's a good job. But, the whole problem is that there is no legal restriction under the basic conflicts of interest law as far as the president is concerned. What we're really talking about are appearances, and those are basically political issues. And I think that given the amount of political advice that Mr. Trump received during the Republican primaries and the general election, I think we can all sit back and rest assured that he's quite capable of making those political calls himself.
Well,
I think, David, let me interrupt for a second. I think we might have Professor Painter back on. Professor Painter, can you hear us, and can we hear you now?
Yes, and I missed part of this, and then I listened to part. I couldn't speak. I got my mic was up. But a number of things with respect to how to deal with this as a business matter. I don't think we're going to be able to do an initial public offering before January 20. I don't think President-elect Trump expected to win this election.
But that
doesn't mean that we can't think seriously about an initial public offering you know, as soon as it can be done with respect to a lot of these holdings. A lot of American families do that and take the company public. Indeed, Ford Motor Company was brought up, and that has gone public. And, yes, the Ford family kept a controlling share of that. But Henry Ford did not become president of the United States. And, by the way, I think he would have been an awful president, given his attitude towards some racial minorities. You know, if someone becomes president, that's a good reason to take the company public. And many American families have their business go public for a lot of different reasons. Leverage buyouts are a possibility. There are a range of options. We can't do all of it before January 20. But we are going to, you know, I think we need to take this seriously and think about what the best options are. Otherwise, we're going to get litigation against these businesses where people are trying to drag Donald Trump into court, pulling up that Jones v. Clinton case and saying they get to sue the president.
Richard, forgive me. I've had a lot of time while you were, Richard. If I may just wait five seconds, I don't want to monopolize this because I had an opportunity to speak a lot while you're not here. But let's be real. I'm very familiar with Jones case. Once the president relinquishes, which is what I advocate, any operational control, and there remains only a beneficial owner, given the fact that Article 3 is supposed to exercise considerable respect for the unique responsibilities of a president, which is clear in the Jones opinion, I can't think of no circumstance where any suit against any of President Trump's business entities would drag him in. So if a hotel in Mumbai collapses, you know, 6 months from now, and it's a branded hotel, there's absolutely no way to drag the president into it. He has absolutely no operational role. So you cannot, you know very as well as I do, and every lawyer in this call knows, you cannot drag a shareholder into that type of scenario.
A controlling shareholder you can drag into litigation quite easily. And I don't,
the controlling shareholder who relinquished, excuse me, Richard, who relinquished all of his control remaining during the time he's in office, entirely a beneficial owner? Don't think so.
I think you can take him in there, particularly if some of the conduct occurred when conduct. And we're going to have to deal with that. It's going to be a pain in the rear, just like Jones v. Clinton was. And maybe the Supreme Court was wrong on that. But the problem is that he's going to have to deal with it, and so is the country. And I just hope we can sell off at least the businesses that are prone to litigation, where the plaintiff's lawyers are going to just be harassing for the next 4 years.
Well, gentlemen, we've got 2 minutes left. I think we're out of questions from the audience. There's one question pending, but with apologies, we're not going to get to that final question. Let me give you each, you know, really, if you could, just 60 seconds to wrap up. Let's go in reverse order. Richard Painter, Professor Painter, 60 seconds for a final thought here.
Well, I think there are a range of options here. Obviously, complete divestiture of most of the businesses is the best option. I think it's the best option for a successful presidency. And there'll be some sacrifice, but I think he can do the deal. He's good at doing deals, and he's not going to be selling anything at fire sale prices. That's just not Donald Trump. And I hope that he thinks seriously about what he can get rid of by way of these personal holdings in order to be an effective president. If he retains businesses, he's going to have to make absolutely sure that we don't have unconstitutional payments from foreign governments, that we don't have a security risk from putting his name on buildings in high-risk areas around the world, and we don't have other scandals. I want to see him be a good president. So I hope he takes these steps as soon as possible.
We all want to see him as a good and successful president. I think all Americans do. Respect to Richard, I think what he's proposing would have bad policy implications, is legally and constitutionally unnecessary, and is not even viable. Therefore, it should be rejected. What I've suggested is, again, would be a significant constraint on operational flexibility of those business entities. Never been done with any president before, would be quite a sacrifice, and would be perfectly sufficient to give confidence to the American people that things are being done properly.
Well, I want to thank both gentlemen for the phone for being on the phone today. Apologies that we couldn't find Professor Painter for the second half of the program. He was on the phone, but we just had some technical difficulties there. But again, thanks to Professor Richard Painter, David Rifkin as well. Thanks to the audience for dialing in, for your thoughtful questions. Please check in with the Federalist Society's website and your emails for information on the next scheduled Teleforum conference call. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.